Now her shift was over, and it was at last time for her to do her own thing. With the door closed behind her, she was immediately into her partial immersion frame, then standing on a virtual plane. Manipulating some floating icons, she called up diverse views and the results of sampling tests transmitted by some of Jerusalem's drones. Translucent pillars of data appeared all around her, scrolling her requirements around themselves. The worms, living in the icy moonlit that now turned in her virtual sky, created burrows similar to those delved by Dragon. Breaking open one icon, she caused a segment of the moon to disappear, and, like a huge worm-eaten cheese, it dropped closer for her inspection. Even though information about these creatures was already on file through a transmission made by the Jack Ketch, Mika still found them fascinating. There was one aspect of them that was plainly similar to Dragon, as it had once been, on Asta Calora, where the human race had first encountered it. There seemed to be no supporting ecology for them. Mika could only hypothesize that the ecology of which they were a product had been destroyed or was somewhere far from here, and that begged many critical questions. Their lone survival made it unlikely they were just the primitive helminth survivors of some natural cataclysm, or had been transported accidentally. Therefore, they must be very like Dragon in another respect. They must be the product of an ecology, in the same way that a golem android was the product of Earth's. It was certain that they had not evolved naturally to their present state.
"Fascinating, isn't it?" interjected Jerusalem, appearing beside her.
"What is?" Mika asked.
"Life. But then, what is life? Those worms grinding their way through spongy rock, are they life? Is Jane technology life? Am I?"
"Ah, philosophy." Mika didn't bother to venture a reply. Jerusalem went on relentlessly.
"In terms of evolved life, those worms are neither one thing nor the other. They have evolved, yes, but prior to that minor change, they were not the direct product of insensate evolution."
"Pardon?" The floating metal head tilted, and a long helical molecule arched across the sky like some strange species of rainbow.
"You have not yet noted the regularity of their genetic blueprint, the lack of equivalence to alleles and parasitic DNA."
"Yes, I saw that." Mika repressed her annoyance. She had discovered something, but it was irritating to learn Jerusalem had found it long before her.
"And what is your assessment?"
Mika replied, "A manufactured organism of some kind, probably intended for mining."
"So it would seem," the AI agreed. "They accumulate rare metals inside their bodies for no purpose related to their own survival."
Mika winced. She had missed that aspect.
"And they procreate only when those metals have reached an internal saturation level that interferes with their tunneling efficiency."
"They could be Jane tech," Mika offered.
"They are not Jane in themselves, being simple mechanisms with only one purpose. However, someone using Jane technology could have made them. Some of the tunnels in that moon are over 500,000 years old. Perhaps the Atheter or the Kasorians?"
Mika considered that. There had been no finds classified as Jain artifacts any younger than 5 million years of age. That was, she acknowledged to herself, excepting products directly attributable to Skellor. Perhaps unknown aliens had left these worms here, but if so, where were they themselves now? Perhaps this was all that remained of yet another race which had stumbled upon Jain technology. We should set up a research... The words died in her mouth when she felt that drag into the ineffable as the Jerusalem dropped into U-space. She braced herself for any turbulence, surprised Jerusalem had given no warning.
The illegal user has ceased to function, Jerusalem informed her before she could ask.
Something prodded him to consciousness, and as he surfaced, Cormac could feel Jain tech all around his mind, like a hostile encircling army wielding a forest of edged and pointed weapons. Sharp steel hedged him in. He was poised on the brink of annihilation. Opening his eyes, he found himself bound into the co-pilot's chair by hard Jain substructure. He could not move his head, for the structure bound that, too, and penetrated it. "Obviously you don't have a quick death in mind for me," he suggested. The lander was still under acceleration, and an indigo sky liberally dotted with stars filled the viewing screen. Skellor, leaning forward with one hand resting on the pilot's console, glanced over his shoulder.
"I don't even know that I'll kill you at all. Maybe I'll rewire you so that you're in constant agony. Or I could subvert you like was done to Mr. Crane, turn you against your masters. Maybe I'll do both."
"Oh, you are so spoilt for choices. It must be such a trial for you." Agony speared from the base of Cormac's skull and down his spine. He arched against his restraints, too ravaged by the pain to even scream. It went on, and his consciousness refused to leave him. He began to break, thought processes now operating in his gridlink because they were unable to function in his organic brain. He realized there, with arctic precision, that this was how Afrin had carried on, understood this separation. Then, after an age, the pain stopped. Cormac gasped for air, spat blood from where he had bitten through the tip of his tongue, wished he could wipe the tears from his eyes.
"You see," said Skellor, "with the Jain substructure supporting your body, I can do that to you for hours without you going into shock or losing consciousness or retreating from reality. Of course, if I rewired your brain and body, I could do so much more."
Cormac became weightless in his Jain carapace, and slowly black space scrubbed away the indigo seen through the screen. Eventually the colony ship became visible, and Cormac could feel the lander decelerating to dock. Skellor would now have to move him from the lander to the main ship. Perhaps he could do something then. The horror, he understood, of occupying the moral high ground by being prepared to pay so heavy a price was that this did not exempt you from actually paying. He knew that, given time, Skellor could destroy that same morality, could turn him into a whimpering thing who would obey the man's every whim, could turn him into the complete negative of everything he was, and could make him suffer endlessly. Briefly, through the bulwarks of his mind, Cormac glimpsed a void where all that he amounted to meant nothing. But he then decided that he must continue to function as if that void could never exist. He must remain an ECS agent to the last. Skellor's mental link to him was very close. He could feel thoughts and memories bleeding over, could feel that the man needed little excuse to cause Cormac pain. He decided to be sparing with sarcasm so as not to provoke the man. He also routed the bleed over from Skellor's mind into his gridlink and stored it. "What are your intentions, other than causing me pain?" he asked. Skellor glanced sideways, and Cormac observed dark movement under the apparently human skin of the man's face. Whirls of scar tissue now filled the holes Cormac had drilled with his thin gun into Skellor's body. Those holes penetrated what appeared to be baroque leathery armour, which Cormac realised was actually part of the man. One hole, at Skellor's waist, seemed to have become cancerous, scar tissue having welled up and spilled over, setting in a fungal growth containing small, egg-shaped nodules. Cormac wondered if this meant Skellor was not entirely in control of the Jane technology, though it seemed more likely that the man just did not care how he looked. "My intentions," Skellor repeated, the question seeming to momentarily confuse him. "Perhaps you should try to guess them." Without even thinking about it, Cormac found himself flexing his muscles rhythmically against the hard structure that bound him, just as he would have worked against any conventional bonds. He considered stopping doing this, but didn't. Had to try every possibility. "I don't know enough. I don't know why you came here in search of Dragon. I don't know if your main motivation is survival or aggression, or if it is something else now utterly alien to me." "Suppose it is aggression. What should I do?" "I don't think I should give you any ideas you might not have had already." The renewed pain slammed him about, writhing against the entrapping structure. He had freedom to scream, locked his jaw against it. Eyes open wide, he saw the world with startling clarity, like a blind man achieving vision whilst being burnt at the stake. An age passed, and then another. "Answers a question." Skellor's voice came out of some dislocated reality. It took some seconds for Cormac to realize that the pain was gone, and to reassume control of his organic brain, emerging from those places he had retreated to within his gridlink. Briefly, he experienced one of his captor's memories, a market stall on a world undergoing terraforming, a plastic box containing pieces he recognized as Jane tech, and something else, an egg. Cormac dismissed this memory to storage. It was no help to him now. "I would attack," he began, then paused as he lost the thread for a moment. "You should attack using manufactured viruses, disease, plague, biological warfare. You have the capability to create something to kill people faster than boosted immune systems, autodocs, or AI-manufactured counteragents can prevent it. You could also send the virtual versions of all of these against AI." Cormac felt no guilt in saying this to Skellor. If the man had not already thought of these methods of attack, then he had been severely overestimated. And anyway, the polity had been preparing for, as well as countering, such attacks from separatist organizations for centuries now. "But how would I distribute such plagues? I could never get such things past the biofilters and scanners of the Runcible network." "You have a ship." The colony ship now appeared as a curved metal horizon, viewed through the front screen of the lander, and even as the pane hit again, Cormac heard the hiss and whine of hydraulics, felt the lander judder, and heard docking clamps thump home.
"So I should personally visit each world in turn, for the purpose of biological and virtual attack?"
Skellor detached his hand from the console, pushing himself up and away from it.
"Just how many worlds do you think I'd manage to attack before I ended up with ECS sitting on top of me?"
Cormac closed his eyes. It felt to him as if someone was sequentially smacking each of his vertebrae in turn with a hammer. He writhed and fought. Then, suddenly, unbelievably, the Jane substructure binding him began to loosen and move. Hope surged in him as the pain also faded. Then he saw Skellor grinning at him.
"Come with me," said the biophysicist.
Cormac pushed out of the chair, the substructure moving plastically around him like an alien exoskeleton. He turned and propelled himself after Skellor towards the airlock. He had not wanted to move or to obey. It was the structure itself moving him, an exoskeleton controlled from elsewhere. In the lock, he stood immobile, while Skellor subverted the door's controls. He then wondered why Skellor had used this method to control him, and not simply attached another of those org insects. Hearing his thoughts, Skellor said,
"Your body is just a machine that I can rebuild any time I like. Your mind, I have decided to keep sacrosanct for now. If I destroy it, how can it appreciate its own suffering?"
The man was lying. Cormac realized that in an instant, but it was knowledge that availed him nothing. The airlock opened, and they propelled themselves out of it into the body of the ship. Cormac's first breath was a dry gasp from the inside of a rusting pipe. In seconds, he was gasping for oxygen. Nevertheless, perpetually on the point of suffocation, he followed Skellor up into the control bridge.
"Of course, I won't allow your body to die for the present, as I don't want to take the trouble to rebuild it," Skellor told him. "You'll not suffocate, though that's how it feels."
On the bridge, Skellor impelled Cormac to clean the captain's chair of the dead man's sticky remains. Still gasping, he carried out his grim task, glimpsing Skellor inspect the cancerous scar tissue at his own waist. The biophysicist then looked up in irritation and allowed Cormac more freedom. Cormac immediately pulled up the hood of his environment suit, closed the visor, and breathed real air. Skellor had obviously tired of that game. Stacking bones and dried-out skin to one side, the agent observed Skellor remove his thin gun from some hidden pocket and place it on a nearby console. Another, more subtle torture. Then the rogue biophysicist pressed his hand down on the main computer console. After a hiatus, he tilted his head back and issued a sound somewhere between a scream and a snarl. Chapter 23. It has ever been an instinct to abhor the different and hate the alien. And like many of those human drives stemming directly from selfish genes, it is one easily controlled or even banished. Human history is littered with hideous crimes, decades of strife and near genocides because of such drives. It should be different now. planetary national borders are non-existent. Most people are of evidently mixed race, and they can change their racial appearance and sex at will, or even simply cease to be human. One would suppose this has rendered reasons for hate impotent. Not so. Catadapts will detest Rodapts, who in turn are hostile to Ophidapts, for no more reason than reflecting a pale imitation of Terran predator-prey cycles. Many humans consider AIs an abomination, and many loathe them, as the superior or rulers have always been loathed. Purebred humans can find hymens repugnant, and hymens can consider pure humans primitive animals. To dispense with these hatreds, we need not to want them. Unfortunately, people cherish their bigotry, misanthropy, and animosities, and they don them like well-worn and well-loved clothes. From How It Is by Gordon. Tanaquil wanted to rage at the strange oldster because he saw Fethan as part of Jilin's death and the current Metalia disaster. Did this now also mean that Tanaquil's dream was dead? That the entire Metalia dream was dead? Would he ever get to stand on the bridge of the Ogygian? He wanted to reject the alien, the interfering outsider. But Tanaquil had been well educated and was harshly intelligent, and believing the man's claim to have caused the demise of the horrible enslaving creatures, he could not allow anger to triumph over reason. So only one task remained. A short walk from where so many broken corpses lay scattered brought him to an abandoned Metalia house. He searched the storage areas underneath it and found a couple of spades. Without question, the old man took the one Tanaquil passed him. In silence, they returned to the charnel house and began to dig. Out of the drifting smoke walked a skinny youth with blonde hair, who gaped at his surroundings with raw and horrified eyes.
"Sir, what do we do now?"
Tanaquil wanted to scream at him, just scream wordlessly. "Bury them," he growled. Other people arrived, some to help dig, and others carrying weapons to guard against the things shifting in the dark of the undercity, no doubt lured by the smell of fresh meat. Tanaquil gave no more than that initial instruction. That those who had not heard it carried out his orders anyway, he reckoned was due to some residue of that enslaving bond they had all recently felt. The corpses must also be buried or burnt before nightfall, else the place would be crawling with sleers. For Tanaquil the task was endless horror. His head ached horribly, and a liquid kept seeping out of the hole behind his ear. But he wanted Jilin in the ground, safe from hard mandibles, and a fast closure, so that he could again rule his people. It was cold, but otherwise he would just fail. To begin with, he just dug in a nightmare fugue. Then he began to realize how the older man wielded his shovel with almost impossible ease, excavating huge clumps of the sandy earth and heaving them aside. Fethan paused and shrugged when he noted Tanaquil's scrutiny.
"Used to dig drainage sluices on Masada," he explained.
Tanaquil nodded, not really understanding. He could push his own blade only half its length into the ground, then had to strain to lever up half a spadeful of earth. Fethan could shove the blade of his tool fully into the soil as easily as if into a pie, and each time the spade's solid metal handle flexed alarmingly.
"You talked often with Dragon?" Fethan suddenly asked.
"No."
Did you ever go to the plain?
Tanaquil shook his head. He could not speak, and was grateful when Fethan pressed him for nothing more. Together, in silence, they completed the task. Then, together, they laid Jilin in the hole they had prepared. Her skin was now cold. Tanaquil scrambled from the grave on his hands and knees and puked acid bile.
I'll finish off for you, said Fethan.
No, insisted Tanaquil, returning to work. He scooped a spadeful of sandy earth down onto Jilin's naked body. Once, twice, then staggered away. He couldn't breathe down here. He could not live in this shadow. The world seemed to go away for a while. Past him flashed a chaos of twisted metal, stairs, people shouting questions at him as he ran. The blimp tower eventually provided refuge, and with no one around he tried to release that lock inside himself. But again, the tears would not come. Instead, he just grew calm and cold, knowing that this was something he could never get over. He did not want to live. Didn't have the will to die.
Tell me about Dragon, a voice intruded.
Fethan had walked quietly out onto the platform beside which was moored the remaining blimp, perhaps holding back somewhat because Tanaquil was sprawled by a pillar right next to the edge.
He took the Undercity as his own, right from the beginning, said Tanaquil, not even knowing why he was explaining. That was 30 years and 4 chief Metaliers ago.
About right, said Fethan, studying the blimp. The 4 spheres separated over 50 years ago, Solstan.
He turned to Tanaquil.
That's the mean time of the human polity, something you need as a standard when you ship out between the stars, shedding decades like dandruff.
Now Tanaquil felt angry because the man had stirred his curiosity.
Spheres? Solstan? Human polity?
Dragon's original form was one of 4 conjoined and living spheres, each about 1 kilometer in diameter. They were one being, which then broke into 4. One of those 4 came here.
Tanaquil remembered visions from his time of nightmares. He pointed out over the sand towers towards the plain. I saw it rise up and leave us. Dragon is gone. Fethan was abruptly up beside him.
Perhaps we should go and see.
He gestured to the blimp. There was more here than an interest in Dragon, Tanaquil thought.
Why would you want to see?
I won't lie to you. While you've been here, I've spoken to your people, wandered your city. There's someone I need to find, and that person does not seem to be here. That being the case, he is, maybe, out that way.
Fethan nodded towards the plain.
He'll always be where the action is.
I cannot leave my people.
They know you need time. I've spoken to some of them.
Tanaquil could not summon the energy to argue, and there was something attractive about climbing into the blimp cabin and just sailing away. Perhaps stepping out into the air when the blimp was high was the only way to release the leaden lock in his chest. One day, Anderson decided, he might ask Unger Salbeck why Bonehead had not fled after the death of Stone, when earlier it had panicked and fled, and why it was now prepared to carry him into battle against the Droon. He suspected the answer related to sentience. A creature that could come to understand human language was not an animal, and probably possessed motivations equally as complex as those of any human. Possibly Bonehead was embarrassed by its earlier behaviour. Whatever. Bonehead remained steady beneath him, its eye stalks spread like a rifle sight below his lance, which he pointed towards the drone as it stepped delicately into the arena he had chosen. Anderson now studied his opponent. The creature stood upright on two chitinous legs, which possessed an extra joint and terminated in feet that were a complex tangle of mismatched digits and hooks. Its tail, counterbalancing its extended upper torso, was ribbed with carapace and square in section, the corners averting so that each of them was sharp as a blade. Halfway down, the tail divided, its twin ends jointed like extra limbs. Carapace also ribbed its upper body, and custard yellow flesh bulged between ribs, forced out by the distension of its overfull guts. Below its primary arms, it possessed two other sets of limbs that served as either arms or legs. Its primary arms ended in large, two-fingered hands. Rows of hooks ran up its forearms to two further digits at its elbows. Its neck, extending from a sloping collar of armour, curved back on itself, swan-like, underneath its ziggurat head. Four black, targeting eyes ran along the lower fold of this head. Six mouths, starting with the largest at the bottom, stepped up its sloping visage to its two distance eyes, slightly protruding and crab-like, set at the very top of its head. When it opened its mouths to expose their bright orange interiors, its head stretched half its own height again. Then the head snapped down, only the top mouth staying open, and the creature made a coughing, hacking sound. It expelled only a mist of acid now, though. Anderson knocked his goad against Bonehead's carapace, and the sandhog began to move forward on its crawler limbs. Straight into some of that custard flesh, bulging from its torso, seemed the best target to Anderson. He knew from his studies that the drone possessed insides similar to a sleer's, its brain being a worm-like organ extending all the way down the length of its body, which obviously made it very difficult to kill with just a headshot. As with sleers, then, his way to kill it was by causing as much internal damage as he could, there being no one particular spot on its body he could target to bring it down. Ho! Bonehead! Ho! The sandhog went up onto its main limbs and accelerated, and it seemed to Anderson that only then did the drone become truly aware of their impending attack. Its head stretched again, and it coughed another fog of acid. Then, like a wrestler preparing to meet an opponent, it extended its arms out to either side. Ho! Ho! The knight centered his lance perfectly on target. If he did not kill it with this charge, then he would certainly be doing it some serious damage. But of course, the resolution of a knightly trial was never simple. At the last moment, the drone brought both its two-fingered hands in and down on Bonehead's carapace. The sandhog juddered to a halt, its momentum driving the drone back 5 meters, the monster's feet cutting furrows in the ground. Anderson slammed against his saddle straps, the saddle itself cracking alarmingly beneath him. The point of his lance went into custard flesh, but not very far at all. Recovering quickly, Anderson leant forward, trying to push it further in, but it was like trying to push a knife into a tree. The drone bellowed, hauled back, nearly snatching the lance from Anderson's hands because he did not have its back eye over its peg. He clung on grimly, though, pieces of yellow flesh and a squirt of clear fluid following the lance tip out. Then, with one hand, the drone slapped the lance aside, its head working like upright bellows as it tried to spit acid it did not contain. The air was full of burning droplets. "Turn to the right! Turn!" Anderson shouted at Bonehead, dropping any pretense that his goad had any effect on where the hog went. Bonehead had meanwhile attacked Low with its feeding head, grabbing one of the Droon's secondary limbs. The hog released this, then pushed away, but the Droon grabbed its back end as Bonehead tried to leap away. Then Thorn and Turgle began firing, their shots either thunking into custard flesh or ricocheting off carapace. Anderson was away then, levelling his lance again as Bonehead ran a circuit of the arena, following his thought, even before he voiced it. The Droon turned on the two men, looming above them, pumping its head and bellowing. It could not see Anderson coming in from the side. He levelled his lance point at an exposed area between the two intermediate limbs. Yah! There came a cracking, ripping sound as 2 meters of lance penetrated the Droon's body. Then, below the knight, everything dropped away. The next thing he knew, he was hanging from the lance, still strapped in his saddle, which had torn away from Bonehead's back. Shit, he said succinctly. He tried to reach down to undo his straps, lost his grip on the lance, and crashed to the ground. Something smashed hard into the back of his helmet and little bright lights chased across his vision. Also winded, he still scrabbled for the straps, but could not seem to find them, was falling into a black tunnel. The Droon loomed over him, horrible gasping sounds issuing from it, and a different coloured liquid oozing from its 6 mouths. No matter. It would not need its acid to finish him off now. Then suddenly the creature turned away. As he slid into unconsciousness, Anderson glanced aside and saw himself, mounted on Bonehead, charging the Droon. Unconsciousness was a welcome escape from this confusion. It was like gazing at the world through a darkened lens, a fisheye vision of whirling stars, a glimpse of the wrecked telefactor and the occasional retreating view of the gas giant. Beside him, entangled with him in the world that could be virtually huge, but was in reality a 20-centimetre lozenge of crystal bound in black metal, Afrin also watched.
"Like a good captain, I would have gone down with my ship," Jack observed.
"Not quite the same. But perhaps you now understand the psychology."
"I was humanized, utterly interfaced with my body, accepting it as part of myself, and its destruction as my destruction." "Interesting. I see that it makes for more efficient attack ships, that investment in the weapon used."
"The ship itself being the weapon," Afrin added.
"You do realize that, though you have managed our survival, utterly disconnected like this, our resources are limited, and we have some choices to make."
"What choices?"
"We can remain conscious at the present level of function for about 10 years, then go into permanent storage. Or we can go into permanent storage right now for 20 years.
"So long. So little."
"The limit of the microtox originally employed to run me while I was transferred from the factory to the ship body, which, incidentally, is now sinking in liquid hydrogen."
"You have contact?"
"No, just a good grasp of physics. The only extraneous link we have is through the pinhead camera that was attached up at the moment of my inception, the purpose of which was to make me aware that there is an outside world."
"We could spend those 10 years in a virtual world," Afrin suggested.
"Such an existence does not interest me."
"Then let us go to permanent storage now. I don't think I could keep this same conversation going for 10 years.
"Then, good night."
Blackness. The hunter-killer program had waited until he was deeply connected into the systems of the ship, Skello knew. And now it was coming at him in a flood, plunging data tentacles into his mind, one after another, so he had time only to defend himself. With too much ease, the attack translated into a VR scenario. Here, it seemed, he grasped the situation more completely as he gained iconic control over his responses. It became almost like some computer game, but a very real one, in which he could actually die. The computer system, in the virtuality, became a planetoid of slightly disconnected blocks, shot through with tunnels and holes, floating in albescent space. Inside this, Skellor was Kali, armed with swords and axes, shifting blocks and seeking a way out. The kill program, one serpent and sometimes many, sprouting like the necks of Hydra from within the planetoid, patrolled these tunnels, attacking him where it could, its attacks increasing in ferocity the nearer he got to the surface of the planetoid, or to gaining some control of its structure. Slowly, Skellor began to identify which collections of blocks represented which ship systems, and the virtuality allowed him to see that every one of these now had its own place for the serpent. He also saw that the deeper into the system he retreated, the easier things became for him, the less assiduously the program attacked him. Closing up the collection of blocks that was the balance control for the primitive hard field shielding of the ship in U-space, and shutting down any access for the program, he realized that unless the same program had resources available he had yet to detect, it would not be able to kill him, nor keep him confined for long. He could only assume that some other plan was in the offing. Before he could plumb that, the program attacked again. Four serpents speared out of the blockish informational darkness. Two of them came for Skellor, and two of them went for the structure he had rearranged. The data stream of one attacker he cut off near its source with a just-prepared virus. In the virtuality, his axe went through its neck, the gaping head fell away, and the body retreated like a severed air hose. His second blow fell on the neck of his other attacker just as it closed its jaws on his arm, punching its fangs into his pseudo-flesh. The neck bent like a cable being struck, but remained undamaged, this data stream having adapted to the virus. His arm immediately began to change colour as killing data began to load. Even as he adapted the virus, he used it swiftly on himself and cut away his poisoned arm. On the backswing, he took off the second serpent's head before turning to the other two, who seemed busily intent on wrecking his work. Now, knowing the degree of adaptation his viruses needed, he sprouted more axes from his fists and attacked, chopping and hacking in a frenzy. Then, when bleeding segments were drifting all about him, he asked himself why this attack had been so strong. Skellor stepped away from the virtual vision of his battle and opened his comprehension to an utterly informational level. He realized that the kill program's defenses were strongest around the hard field generators, the reactor, and the balanced U-space engines of this ship. It wanted to keep him here, in orbit of Kull. That being the case, he now made it his prime objective to get away. He probed tentatively into the startup routines for the U-space engines. The reaction he got, like poking a stick into a nest of vipers, confirmed his suspicions. Now, in the virtuality, and not limiting himself by human perception, he began gathering his weapons. Turning towards those closely guarded systems, he hurled himself forward, thousand-armed, viruses and informational bacilli propagating around him, layered attack programs like swarms of bees, a growing mass, then a wall, of every informational weapon at his disposal falling on that nest of serpents. In a virtual age, he slew the guardians. In real computer time of microseconds, he swamped and subsumed engine control. His diagnostic search informed him of slight misalignments in both engines and hard fields. It would hurt him, but he would survive, as he had before. The fusion reactor started easily. Someone had used it recently, no matter. When enough power was available, he started the fusion engines of the ship. He had no control of navigation, but the ship had been tangential to the planet. Accelerating, burning up rusty water from its fuel tanks as it drove up to ram scoop speeds, the ship left orbit. One fusion chamber sputtered as the water started to run out. Then the ram scoop fields opened out and began funneling in hydrogen and other spatial matter to use as fuel. Then, achieving sufficient speed relative to the fabric of space, like a speedboat ready to move up onto its hydrofoils, the Ugijan engaged its U-space engines and dropped out of real space. Dragged back against one wall of the bridge, the long-dead captain's skull still clutched in his right hand and the Jane exoskeleton now rooting into the metalwork around him, Cormac wondered what new torture this was. But agony twisted Skellor's features, and Cormac's mind screamed at the flashes of grey infinity beyond the screen, all his human perception could make of underspace. Some instinct made him try to grasp more. He opened up programming space in his gridlink to carry the load, but his mind just kept sliding off. Desperation grew in him, as if his survival depended on his cognizance of this dimension. With augmentation, it was possible for him to comprehend more than he could with his normally evolved human mind. With heightened perception, Cormac could visualize five dimensions, see a tesseract, and observe a Klein bottle pouring into itself. But this was more dimensions than that, and none at all. U-space contained the potential for dimension. It was the infinity of a singularity and the eternal instant. To human perception, it was things and states that were mutually exclusive. It was impossible. Impossible for a human to encompass. But Cormac knew that he must encompass it or completely lose one of the bulwarks of his mind. And so, naturally, as he strove for comprehension, he moved further away from his own humanity. With a feeling of good riddance, Dragon watched first the Ugijan, then the King of Hearts, drop into underspace. It being evident that this entire system, and probably others, were enclosed in a user trap, the entity felt sure that neither Skellor nor the rogue AI ship would be going far, and that maybe the polity would survive, just so long as others of its members could resist temptation. Temptation. There was a saying attributed to a 19th-century human character who seemed famous more for his sexual proclivities than his ability with a pen or quill. Dragon knew the dangers of Jane technology, but the option for control of it from its nascent stage. Polity AIs must be aware of this aspect of the technology, and Dragon understood why some of them had gone rogue in pursuit of it.
I can resist anything but temptation.
Dragon also quickly came to understand something else. It was certain that the higher polity AIs had worked out quite some time ago how Jane technology operated. Hence this scenario. The trap had not only been for Skellor, but for those AIs that did not show the requisite self-control. The entity did not like the idea that the same trap might have intentionally included itself, but had to admit that possibility. Whatever. On the surface of Kull was an item that could create another Skellor, or utilized by polity AIs, or Dragon itself. Something even worse. Dragon felt the Jane node would be safer elsewhere. Still working to repair its U-Space engines to shorten the hours-long trip to the planet to minutes, it then detected a U-Space signature. Observing the scale of what was coming through, Dragon felt a sinking sensation in its many thousands of stomachs.
"Now where are you going?" Jerusalem asked.
Strangely, AIs that ran golem bodies were more patient than those which controlled spaceships and runcibles, and whose understanding of time and the universe was immense. Sento waited, utterly still, utterly forbearing, as the hours slogged on past. Only a few hundred meters away from him, down at the bottom of the engine pier in the captain's bridge, the Jerusalem hunter-killer program had immobilized Skellor. Maybe, if he took his APW down there, he could use it to convert the biophysicist to so much ash. But maybe wasn't good enough. That particular maybe was only the contingency plan. "You still have him contained?" he asked, though in reality the question contained no human words. The program responded in the same computer language, "He is contained. Be prepared for your action." The kill program made all the calculations in a Gideon's computer before presenting the idea to Sento. It did this only minutes after Skellor began using the message laser. Sento was dubious of the accuracy of the program's results. It was no ship or runcible AI. In fact, was not designated AI at all. Though Sento admitted to himself, that was probably for reasons of expediency. And the computer on the Ogygian was primitive. However, when the program showed him the scale of the target and its intentions, Sento had to agree. Skellor, no matter what capabilities he possessed, would not be getting away from there. Sento, having now to do the one thing of which the program was incapable, all its actions being on an informational level only, would not be leaving either. But the golem, being AI and of AI origin, and also being backed up in Earth Central, did not view personal destruction in the same way as did a human or Hyman, whatever Fethan thought himself. "There is something else," the program then interjected. "And that is?" "The Skellor has brought a hostage aboard with him." "That is unfortunate," said Sento, "but it does not impinge upon the plan. The loss of one or two lives, even a few hundred lives, is a small enough price to pay to be rid of Skellor." "The hostage is Ian Cormack." Sento experienced spontaneous emotion, something he had not felt since seeing Ulrich die and then finding the incinerated corpses of Shaden and Horn. First he felt surprise that the agent had allowed Skellor to capture him at all. Then he felt sadness. Cormack did not back himself up. and even if he was memplanted, that technology would not survive what was to come. The agent would die irretrievably. That makes no difference. The program fell silent, returning that small sliver of its awareness to the chaos of its virtual battle to keep Skellor contained and unaware of the subtle control it exerted over the ship's helm. Many hours later, precisely to the calculated second of ship time, Cento pointed his APW at the superconducting cables leading to the U-Space engine above him, triggered the weapon, and drew violet fire across. The blast threw him back. The side of the support pier blasted out into U-Space, the blobs of molten metal creating strange kaleidoscope effects as they departed the ship. Above him, the engine stuttered out something weird that impinged even on Cento's golem consciousness as, briefly, the Escon ducts carried proton energy back into it before flaring like burning magnesium. Then, suddenly, black and starlit space bled into the gap as the Ogygian resurfaced. Cento closed an arm around a bubble metal I-beam as something pulled hard at him for a moment, released its hold, then pulled again. Tidal forces, he surmised. Weakened by the APW blast, the pier twisted above him. He felt its wrenching scream through the metal he clutched, observed the beam itself twisting. Then that force tugged again, and the U-Space nacelle, along with much of the pier above him, tore away from the ship. Cento observed its slow departure, then turned his attention to where he calculated their destination would be. The brown dwarf seemed a vast wooden sphere looming at them out of the dark. The Ogygian was already being dragged down towards it, already being torn apart by its tidal forces. Cento headed down towards the bridge. Now, to make sure, he would also carry through the contingency plan. It would be a pointless, though satisfying, exercise, for in a few hours Skellor, the ship, and all detached debris, Cento and Ian Cormack, would constitute a very thin film on the dead sun below. Somehow, the barrier had remained, a shimmering silk meniscus between Mr. Crane and everything real. Yet strangely, by this separation, he could view the world and his worlds, and discern what was now and what was then. The surreal battle between a knight mounted on a giant crustacean and the ziggurat-headed droon was real and was now. Briefly, it reflected on the etched game board, before the vulture brought her players back to order with a sharp peck and a lengthy swallowing. Crane moved the piece of crystal and gazed up at the sea's surface. It was fantastically bright up there, almost as bright as revelation. Inside his head, he felt something turn and clunk into place with all the positivity of a ship going into a docking clamp. Tearing off the aviapt's head had not been a particularly moral act, nor had Crane's killing of Starlek been particularly nice. But for what they had done to him, and likely done to others, they deserved death. Also, they had been outside the polity, and Crane had been under instruction. In some part of himself, Crane recognized the mealy-mouthed dissimulation of a coward. Though ordered through the Pelter's control unit to kill those two, he had not needed to be quite so bloody. He reached down to move a blue acorn. A beak intervened, and he instead moved the scent bottle. Taut excitement filled him, and imminence. That was the only way the various parts of his mind could see it. Something of all his parts was poised on the edge of the reel, waiting to come into focus. The sea's surface drew no closer. He knew he was not ready for that. But some bright structure, like a vast glassy plankton, turned in electric depths and presented itself to another mass of the same. It keyed in, locked into place, took on the same spectral pulsation as all the rest. Mr. Crane stared down at one brass hand. It was utterly real, and utterly right there and then. Folding in his thumb, he saw himself tearing people apart on chain three. Those were Arian Pelter's orders, and the man had been nested close in Crane's mind, his control, through a military org, all but absolute. How could the golem have done otherwise?
Lies. Lies. Lies.
Crane folded in a finger, remembered killing policemen, then killing one of Arian's allies. But one of those policemen had survived. Out of an impossible situation, Mr. Crane had allowed someone to live. The antique binoculars he had taken in place of the life, now replaced by the scent bottle he had just moved. Hadn't he saved so many lives? But counting the deaths, he soon ran out of fingers. The little knight, mounted on a miniature sandhog, charged the lion's tooth and, prodding it with his lance, moved it to a new position. Two bright structures mated with a satisfying click and the gratifying alignment of the last turn on a Rubik's cube. What Crane had done, he could have done nothing else. Crane could have done nothing else. Rising, nemesis from the sea, Mr. Crane was angry. He raged at a life denied him, howled inside at the Serban Kline they wanted him to be, was rabid because there was nothing inside or out to prevent him killing. But there was justification. The people on this island had done those horrific things to Semper. They had unmade a human being piece by piece, scream by scream, and left him to marine crucifixion for Crane to find. Oh,